All right. I would like to welcome everybody to the Game Tech Leadership Summit. I'm Jonathan Blow, and this is Jeff Lander in the front of the room here. And if you have any questions over the course of the next 2 days, you can ask one of us. I would like to start by explaining just what Game Tech Leadership Summit means. If I can... Okay. The basic idea is that when it comes to game development these days, the tech lead is very, very important. And what I mean by tech lead is not necessarily somebody with the title tech lead, because titles mean different things at different companies, but basically either the person in charge of, you know, the tech team making a bunch of engine decisions, or the lead programmer on the game, or, you know, some various group of people in the position to make authoritative technical decisions. As Casey put it, the tech lead is the linchpin of modern game development, which is not necessarily to say that he's the only linchpin, because, for example, it can be pretty hard to make a game without the all-important guy who has all the money that you need. But nevertheless, the tech lead is in a very crucial position where very good decisions can make things go very well and very poor decisions can sink the entire game. The reason is the rest of the team, for example, artists and designers, can only really do their work via the systems that we build and provide for their work to enter the game, right? They all use programs to create and manipulate data. And to the extent that they are effective or ineffective, right, we bear a large responsibility to make their work possible, to make it smooth, to make it high quality, right? I mean, certainly if they're good artists, they can do high quality work, but if they have really lousy tools, that's going to have a big impact. So the previous 2 days of this conference, for those of you who were here, was about engineering the algorithms that we use, right? The rendering or the animation synthesis and things like that. These next 2 days are going to be about studying and engineering the process that we use to make those algorithms make things happen. Because you can have the best algorithm in the world, but if you don't manage to get it running smoothly in the game for whatever reason, you might as well not have it. This is important because we sort of have this endemic process problem in the game business, right? Even the best and brightest games have really obvious problems that really ought not be that way, despite being many-year projects and tons of millions of dollars spent on them, right? They take a long time to develop. They can ship with a lot of features cut, being not really the game that the developers envisioned, right? There's all sorts of just miscellaneous problems. For example, maybe the end user has long load times due to all this data, and, you know, maybe if that had been taken as a more serious problem by the developers, maybe they could have narrowed that down, right? Streamlined the loading, or this one is kind of ironic, right? Some games have really obvious graphics and animation problems, maybe because the tools didn't make it very easy to integrate animation with gameplay or something. But meanwhile, you know, the tech team worked very hard on the shaders and the various graphics algorithms, and those algorithms would be really beautiful if they had a chance to actually do what they were trying to do, but they don't quite, right? So what we're trying to say here is that this process stuff is at least as important as the algorithms that it governs. So to the extent that the process has problems, the tech lead is in the unique position to solve them and must solve them if the game is going to be successful. And because he's got a team of people working with him, right, it's not like he's sitting down and doing all the solutions himself. He's got to orchestrate that team, right, and kind of maneuver them to solve the problem. And to do this is not easy, right? There's two things that you really have to know. You've got to have a broad and clear view of the game that your team's working on, right? So you've got to know what all that code does and know what the artists are trying to do and know what the designers want to be able to visualize and kind of what feedback they want to get. And you've got to be able to make that happen, right? And in order to know where to go, right, so your code is at a certain state, right, of capabilities that the team is able to have. And you want to make decisions about what state to move that code into so that you're developing your game is even more effective, right? And so you've got to be aware of the possibility space, right? What could we do? What tools could we make, right? How nice should our animation be able to look? what have other teams done? What other processes have they explored, right? And how did that work out for them? So there's a bunch of knowledge that we need to have, and we can never do a perfect job of having that knowledge, but we've got to try. So here's the plan for today. There's two types of events going on interleaved. The things here in orange, wow, those colors are not necessarily too visible, but hopefully you can read them. The things in orange are very ambitious games that, you know, a person in a position of significant authority on each of those games is going to come up and talk about. Between those, we've got some meals, lunch and dinner with some sponsored lectures. And these lectures are probably going to be a little bit less process-oriented and a little bit more traditionally technically oriented. Okay, so for each of those games, there's sort of this three-phase thing that's going to happen. There's going to be the lecture where the lecturer just basically gives about a presentation of about an hour. Following that, there'll be a question and answering period. But okay, here's the sort of different thing, which is that following that, we're going to try and segue the question and answers into a more open discussion. And here's where the summit part of the leadership summit comes in. The idea is that the people in this room are sort of a very high quality audience. And so roundtable style discussion is really valuable in that context, more valuable than it might otherwise be. So we're going to try to encourage that. So after the Q&A, you know, we're going to shift into this phase where if you've got anecdotes that relate to what we've been talking about or, you know, some process idea that you think is relevant, we'll just hand you the mic and you can talk for a couple minutes, and then that'll probably spur some more discussion and things like that. Okay, so as I've said, these are lectures. They're given by technical people, so they will be technically aware. They will have a technical emphasis. But at the same time, we're not talking about algorithms almost ever, right? We're talking about process. I've asked the lecturers to illustrate their talks with a lot of concrete low-level examples to help make it not totally touchy-feely, right? To help give you a very concrete handle on what they're saying. But there is going to be some abstract philosophy going on here too, because it's very important to understand why people made these decisions that they made. Okay. It just so happens that of the four games we're going to talk about today, two are PC games and two are Xbox games. Like, that's just how it worked out. I don't want you to think there's any kind of platform bias here. Tomorrow, the presentations that we're going to talk about, yeah, one of our sponsors is Sony, so like, he'll, yeah. Tomorrow, we've got some stuff relevant to the other platforms. It's just that today, it's how it happened. I would like to take a minute to thank our sponsors, Intel, Sony, and ATI, for helping to make this event possible. And I would like to thank our advisory board, who did a great job of both helping to set the tone of the conference, especially this part, which is a little bit different and more experimental, and reviewing the materials and providing feedback. And I would like to remind everyone, we've passed out some evaluation forms that you have in front of you, and please, you know, rate what you thought of each lecture as it happens and hand them in to us at the end of the day. This is a very important channel of communication between you and us that we can use to help make the conference better. And in fact, we do read them at night and adjust based on what you said for the next day. So if you're, you know, unhappy about something, we can really attempt to handle that. So that's that. I'd like to introduce our first speaker, who is Jay Stelly from Valve. He's going to talk about Half-Life 2, and I don't think he needs much of an introduction, except to say that, you know, you should really care about this lecture, because Half-Life 2 is one of the most technically ambitious games in a long time. It's pretty rare that people even try half the stuff that they did, and so I'm honored to have him here. So go for it, Jay.
So today, I want to talk to you guys about Half-Life 2 and the Source Engine and kind of development over at Valve. And I think I want to start first with talking about the notion of a tech lead, given the topic of this conference. For me, I've worked on several projects over the years, and kind of early on, I guess my idea of a tech lead was the person who knew basically, you know, they're the person who works on all your hardest problems, the person who coordinates and reviews all the other developers' work, the person who is the last person checking in code when you go to ship, it's like described like that. It's really heavy amount of responsibility, and eventually I got to work on projects where I was a tech lead, sort of by that definition, and then things kind of changed when I came to Valve. So when I came to Valve for Half-Life, we had basically 5 programmers, and really 3 of the programmers were very senior with a lot of experience, and one of those guys became the sort of development manager, but wasn't the person always working on the hardest problems. Those were kind of divided among the group, and wasn't the last person checking in code, but they were responsible for all of the stuff. You know, the management part of it was just more work, right, just like the programming was, being responsible for all that stuff getting done and having the long view, but we had kind of divided some of the tech lead responsibility. Then we shipped Half-Life, and we went to start on Half-Life 2, and by the time we had built the team that would later go on to do the Source Engine, we had 14 programmers, and 7 of those guys in their previous job had been the tech lead or the development manager or lead programmer. So it didn't really make sense for us to say, okay, we have this, you know, we're gonna do, you know, this one person will be the tech lead, and, you know, we'll drive all of our decisions through that person. So we really have divided responsibility at Valve. It's kind of a group of peers. And what I would say for myself personally is that going from being a programmer on a project where there was a tech lead to being the tech lead by myself to then not being the tech lead by myself, my job got a lot more fun, a lot easier, and a lot more rewarding. I mean, I found a lot of times when I was responsible for some of the hardest problems that you didn't ever get to work on anything enough, having to look at the whole scope of things. So if you're in a situation where you have that structure, I would encourage you to kind of think about, you know, your next hiring decisions, hiring your peers, and taking some of the weight off of individuals, because I think it works really well for us. So just a little bit of philosophy there to get started. So that being said, there are a bunch of kind of tech lead decisions that a bunch of different people made at Valve. And I'm going to go through a few of these that, you know, things that worked well for us, and then some things that didn't work as well. And we had a bunch of things that we had to go through. Like I said, I'll start with development. I'm going to go through also our content production pipeline and some other high level technical issues. So for code development, like I was saying, we had grown from basically a group of five programmers shipping Half-Life to 14. That we were sharing between Half-Life 2 and TF2. We decided to share developers and code. But we have a large group of engineers, a larger code base, a lot of technology investment going on. The existing code base we started with had a lot of dependency, and architecture wasn't really set up for 14 people to go to work. And we had 2 different kind of architectural goals between, you know, a lot of system coding going on. I'm sure this is similar to everyone else's game. So you have a lot of system coding going on, but at the same time you have a lot of kind of leaf coding going on where you're coding one-off and game-specific behavior. And the choices you make about how to structure that are different than how you structure, you know, core systems where you're talking about loading and managing assets, running core technology like, you know, collision detection or rendering. Versus the game behavior, where you're going to make different choices, and we're investing in lots of new technology, and there's lots of interactions between those technologies. So we've got to make some good high level choices to make all that work out okay. So one of the things we really wanted to do is reduce the scope of a lot of these programming decisions. So a lot of our architecture was driven around workflow and who's going to do the work and how, and what's the smallest possible scope they can do their work so that they can, you know, the idea is that a lot of our processes, and I'll touch on this again with content, are fundamentally iterative, where you do a bunch of work and then you get together with other people on the team and evaluate it, and then you do more work and then you evaluate it and you do more work. And especially for the content and also for the code, the number of iterations you get through determines the quality of the results. So we want to make things so you can iterate, do a lot of your work in a small scope, and then rapidly converge on the good thing. So one of the things we did early on architecture-wise is go to a pretty heavily dynamically linked code base. So we're on PC, so maybe you wouldn't structure it exactly the same way on a console, but I think you could use similar principles. But we did everything with binary compatibility. So as an example, I have a more detailed example, but I had worked on the physics system, and it was a DLL and exposed an interface of pure virtual to everything else. I rev the physics DLL really often without recompiling anything else in the game. And it was binary compatible, so you could just check in the one DLL. The nice thing about having it be a binary unit, too, is that we shared it in all of our tool chains. So the same physics system that ran at runtime and would also do things like build convex hulls and do speculative queries and tools. So we did something really, it's like really lightweight COM, and I'm sure other people use that, with just versioning and, you know, extensibility kind of factored into it, but not any out-of-process communication or marshalling or any of those things that you get from a heavier weight kind of comm system. But the idea is individual programmers could go off, lay down an interface that sort of says, here's my contract here, so I'm going to communicate with everybody else, and then do a bunch of work, a bunch of iterations behind that interface, interacting with everything else. And this is all going on in parallel with people working on various components. And it worked out really well for us. On the leaf coding side, you really want to work at minimizing the amount of overhead you have to do for leaf coding. And so one thing we did, especially in our game logic, is we built a lot of systems that would do kind of automatic registration, with the idea being that you could even work in one source file for a lot of leaf coding. And this is a really convenient thing. Just being in there, you're writing one unit of behavior as a leaf for the game, and you're in one file, you can use edit and continue, you can sit there and iterate, you can declare all of your behavior, serialization, networking, hooks to the system. So we had general auto-registration things, like you could write a line of code that says, I want to be called when the game loads, every frame, when assets are precached for networking, and all of this stuff. You just create a hook into the system. And it's straightforward. But the choice about how you do that, whether you have to go edit another file and put yourself into a registration routine, or you have to know where that is, or you have to know where the other hooks are, just making some of those choices to where you can live in one file just makes leaf coders, or when you're doing leaf coding, makes you more productive. So some benefits of these approaches, these kinds of things are, it's faster iteration, right? That's the goal. All these little DLLs are smaller than our project was previously. We have less dependencies because the interfaces are a pretty good tool for programmers know what the right decision is, but having the interface there, it's kind of like a wall that makes you put whatever code you're writing on the right side of the wall. We also use distributed compiling tools. There's a really good one for the PC called IncrediBuild that I would recommend. I'm sure some people in here use it. I measured usually 4:1 to 8:1 improvement, and mostly that scales with precompiled headers, and linking has to be done on a single machine. So to the size of your project, if you have a lot of files compiling that can be distributed across, we got up to 12 machines. There's network limitations for that, but that they can be distributed across those 12 machines, then that's really fast. Versus, if your project only has 5 files in it, then it's going to do the 4 files all at once, and or 5 files all at once, and then it's going to link, and most of your time is going to be spent linking, so it's maybe only 2 to 1 or 1.5 to 1 speed up. So really, the variation is based on that. We developed a distributed system, which I'll go into more detail later, called VMPI, that we use to compile shaders and other game content. Most people working in Leaf code would use edit and continue. So they just sit there and incrementally change their code and recompile it with on the PC is really easy. And I know, at least when I've worked on consoles, it hasn't been available. But it's a very convenient thing. You know, if it's only a little bit more work to make sure that it works. We have this console system where you can plug in and edit debugging values and, you know, kind of script things. And so one of our auto registration systems was a way that you could put named variables straight into a piece of Leaf code. And so instead of putting constants, you know, you start off by just putting all these named variables that register into the console. And then when you want to go tune those parameters, you just do it. You can bind it to keys or to a, you know, joystick or whatever you want to do there, and just animate those values in real time while you're looking at the game. And that pattern is really, really useful for getting Leaf code to converge on the right thing, right? That's like a really rapid iteration. And that's kind of the theme of a lot of this stuff. So just to get into a concrete example, our shader system is the bulk of the rendering is in two DLLs. There's a kind of graphics API that abstracts DirectX called Shader API, and there's a higher level layer called the material system, which abstracts the concept of materials. These components were developed and revised independently of all the rest of the engine. We moved from DX8 to DX9 with almost no code changes outside the layer. So originally, we were going to ship DX 6, 7, and 8 range of hardware, and when the game took longer than we wanted, we ended up shipping DX 7, 8, and 9 instead. But we were using the DX 8 API and hardware features, and we transitioned to using DX 9 and HLSL without touching any of the Leaf code. So and for the bulk of the people writing rendering code, that was on the other side of this layer, they didn't really even notice. They just had more shaders, and that was really cool. It's kind of what you would hope would happen if you had done this correctly. So we also, in the material system, it can load plug-in DLLs for shaders, like the there's actually a DLL that loads with all the DX9 shaders in it, and another one that loads for DX8, so that you use less memory on low-end systems. We have a hook for that so that we can actually expose it in our SDK, where mod authors should be able to write HLSL code and link it in for their mod. So all of Leaf code uses this material abstraction. No one writes any D3D code other than people in this Shader API DLL. One of the problems we had is that with DX8, especially, you need lots of custom shaders in order to run fast. And I'm sure people who work on the PC know this very well. If you have lighting on characters that you want to do in hardware, you really need to have the one point light, one directional light shader, and then the two spotlight shader, and the one point light, one spotlight shader, or the one spotlight shader and the three spotlight shader, because the performance is really to your advantage to have a specific shorter shader in all of those cases, or else you can become vertex throughput bound. Same thing with skinning. If you're doing skinning with a lot of bones in a vertex shader, then you end up with a lot of shaders there to work through all the different number of bone weights per vert and combos like that. So we had this kind of metaprogramming approach to that, where we use Perl scripts, and you write HLSL with subroutines, and the subroutines were kind of these blocks like do lighting, and then lighting would say, it's like a template, says here's a spotlight, here's a point light, here's a directional light function, and the Perl scripts would go and remove the sections that weren't to be compiled for each combination, and you have a little meta layer saying, okay, I want these combinations for this shader, and so you'd write and edit one of them and then generate thousands of them. So unfortunately, it was really slow to compile. And once again, we turned to distributed computing there, where we would distribute the compilation of shaders over 32 machines and save lots and lots of time doing that. So you could do a full recompile in minutes instead of tens of minutes. And then we had an incremental loading system, which is, again, based around the idea of iterate quickly in isolation. So you're going to work on this single shader. You break that one out and say, I just want to dynamically load this. And so you edit the shader and reload it, edit the shader and reload it, as opposed to recompiling everything. So one other thing that I'm talking about, we did a little metaprogramming with shaders, and we used HLSL eventually. That was a scripting language that was successful for us. But in general, we didn't get a lot of benefits out of like a general purpose scripting as an idea. And we started off with a language for writing shaders that was our own back with DX8, and eventually just pulled it out and wrote DirectX assembly. We also had another language for doing AI behavior, where we had stuff that looked very much like script sitting in code, and so we turned it into something that was syntactically better, that was sitting in a script file, and we also rolled that back before we shipped. And in both cases, really, it's going back to the point about designing around workflow. Who's doing the authoring of the scripts, and what's the overhead for it, and how do they do their work? And it turned out especially for like AI behavior, almost any time someone was editing one of those scripts, they were an AI programmer. And the kinds of tasks they were doing at the same time involved changing the AI code. And so you were just like making them work in two files instead of one, using two processes instead of one. Even though it simplified one of those processes, the overhead of that just made it not worth it. And in the case of the shader language, it came down to the amount of work we have to put into tools to develop that properly wasn't gonna pay for the increased efficiency there. So when HLSL came along, we jumped on that because it had a lot of the work put into it. But prior to that, doing our own was really kind of a dead end. We did ship kind of this scripting language for defining animations and models, and I'd say that some point in the future we're going to add tools that make it to where no one edits those by hand. So I'm not really super happy with what we've done with sort of general scripting languages. But what we did do successfully with scripting are put a bunch of stuff into configuration kind of files, and I'll give you some examples of that. So these are just text blocks. It's sort of like XML, but just text, just pairs of text in a block, with hierarchy, and that's it. So these are really simple. You could write a parser that could parse any kind of text block. I mean, just like the things you get out of XML. It was infinitely extensible. There's no conditionals or state, so it doesn't have any complex grammar or anything. You could write tools that would just operate on any kind of script and make changes to it. And then we use this for lots of things, like our level format is in this, and we have a bunch of other pieces of game content that are in this. And I'm going to go into some of those as we go through here. So kind of what it's all about, I mean, what John mentioned is in the intro is to really build your tools and your pipeline to improve the creative processes of the people working on the creative parts of the game. And just like we just got through talking about code, it works really well for us to think about the creative processes the same way we think about code. And so, what do we want to do? Well, we want to reduce the scope when you're making decisions to the smallest scope possible. And we want to make it possible for individual people to iterate in isolation rapidly on a particular asset and until they converge on a really good version of it. So we did a bunch of work to decrease the cost of iterations, reduce processing time, just like we try to reduce the compilation cost of code, right? A bunch of work to improve the quality of iteration, so giving you better feedback or giving you more of the pipeline while you're iterating. And then a bunch of work to push dynamic linking and symbolic linking into our content. which is what makes it possible to iterate in isolation. And I'm going to give you several examples of that. But just to say what I mean at the outset, when I'm talking about symbolic linking, I just mean everything's a name until you want to link it together, right? And then when I'm talking about dynamic linking, I just mean that for all of this data, if it's dynamically linked, it's linked in the engine when you go to run it, not in some compilation step. Because there's just a bunch of different meanings you could overload on these words. I know everybody's familiar with them, but I just want to be specific about it. And so the same kind of way you add layers of abstraction to your code, because people are going to do specific kind of work, you want to add layers of abstraction to your content pipeline and choose the architecture around the workflow. Who's going to build it? How are they going to build it? What's the most efficient way for them to build it? What do they want to be abstracted from while they're building it? So over the course of building the source engine, we re-examined all of our core production processes, and I'll go through in more detail on each one of these. And the end result of this, hopefully, is that creative people can iterate in isolation without dependencies, and that means that a bunch of people can be iterating at the same time. So you're hoping to get to higher quality faster. So first thing I want to talk about is level design. In Half-Life, the level design is kind of where everything comes together. The level is the place where you hook the characters and the audio and the animation to a piece of geometry and the game happens, right? In Half-Life, a bunch of that stuff was embedded in the level. And so a straightforward thing we did is just go through and link all the stuff that's embedded, so make it live outside the level file. I'm sure lots of people are doing that similarly. And that way you've got something you can specialize. A specialist can go work on the audio or a piece of animation, and it's only linked by name, and there's not a dependency there that you have to manage while you work on it. We still have a couple of embedded things to remain that remain in the game. We have these things called prefabs that have a whole chunk of level geometry and game logic kind of built out, and then you stamp that down in your level and then customize it. And so that stays embedded, so if someone changes that template, it doesn't get propagated to all the levels that use it. And that just turned out to be a really nasty problem, so we didn't get around to solving it. But it's still useful to have embedded stuff. The only reason I'm mentioning is to contrast with the stuff that's really linked and talk about how you get these other benefits that you can't get. So level design was one area where scripting, in a sense, was successful and pretty powerful. Although it's not editing text files. It's more like block diagrams. We have this thing we call entity.io, which is an entity in our language is a game object. So it's one unit of game logic. And it exposes a set of named connections in and out of it with parameters. And basically, it's a symbolic link to some code, right? Each connection, and you can connect the inputs and outputs. In Half-Life, we had this thing called a trigger, which is a volume in space. And when the player walked into it, it had a field in it that was like, "Who do you want me to call this member function on when the player touches that field?" Right? Really simple concept. In Half-Life 2. The same trigger has a set of named outputs, like it also has filters. So like something just touched it, you pass it to a filter to see if you care about it. And then there's a starting touch, ending touch output. And then you just hook those instead of like having a specific member and a specific member function that you're going to call. You hook those to an input of the other thing, right? So it's just a couple more layers of abstraction through that process that are customized, and you've got a lot of scripting, right? I can have a thing that says when you start touching this, have this timer entity start counting, and then when it reaches zero, I have an output that says play the alarm, right? And so we can do a lot of the things that you would traditionally write as little scripts in these kind of block diagrams. And the nice thing about making it all symbolic like this is it's totally extensible. You don't have anything hardwired to any specific code that you have to keep backwards compatible. You can just create new specialized inputs and outputs as you need. So you have, you know, you can even do like once you have a bunch of shipping content you don't want to go touch, well, you can make, you know, start touch, and you can make another start touch that has more data in it or has a wrinkle on how it handles filtering or something like that and stay backwards compatible. So it's just a nice way to abstract it. And I'm sure most people have used similar concepts in code. I know there's popular libraries with similar kind of concept. But we use that for a lot of things we would normally have tried to do with scripting to a lot of success in Half-Life 2. And I'm going to get back to you later about why, you know, linking all this stuff is valuable as I go into other examples. Another thing we did with linking is in Half-Life we had a lot of cases where we wanted to have characters say something to you. And so you would put a thing in the level that says, there's an interesting thing to say here. The way we implemented that, there's a thing called a scripted sentence in Half-Life. And say you have Barney following you around, and you come into a room, the scripted sentence entity says, oh, Barney just walked in, I'm going to make him say this. You know, oh, this is the weapons room, you know, or something like that. And it seems like Barney has something to say relevant to that. And we were scripting that directly into the level. So with Half-Life 2, we added another layer of abstraction, which is instead of directly picking a piece of speech with a script like that, we have this thing called a response system, where you have a contextual link. So some entity IO runs and adds a concept to this thing, saying, I need to, you know, talk about, well, I'll give you an example of, you're in the coast in Half-Life 2, and there's a nearby character, or a set of nearby characters, and a dropship comes in. And the level designer says, when the dropship comes in, I add this dropship context. And so now, as you're walking around, and they decide they want to talk to you because you just walked up to them, or you just pressed use, they have this new context called a dropship's approaching. And then someone can go write in the script file, when you use a guy, and you're in the coast, and a dropship's approaching, and it's a female, play this wave. And you write another one that says, and it's a male, play this wave. It was a way that like our writer added a bunch of richness to the game after all the levels production was done. I mean, you just have this contents hanging off, and you can go. It basically creates this big matrix of possible specialized content, and then you go fill in all the interesting ones. And you can collapse the matrix down to, well, all these things should say this, and you can do specific hacks like this one character should replace all of his speech with these things. Like, he just keeps saying the same thing over and over. So that was a really nice case of, you know, we put another layer of abstraction in there. It got a lot more powerful and a lot more isolated so that, you know, like I'm saying, the writer doesn't have to work very closely with the level designer to achieve a bunch of dialogue. Something else we have in level design, just another example, moving to shaders instead of textures. So one layer of abstraction there, you put down a shader instead of a texture, and it's got rendering code associated with it. It's got a set of textures associated with it. It may even have some game client code that it calls on a regular basis to modify shader variables. And all that just, you could decide that, this particular material is going to have this proxy that calls the game logic to glow red when the player gets close to it or something after a level designer's already placed that in the level. So an artist can go do that without talking to the level designer. Just in general, the theory was people are going to block things out and work rough, and they're going to go as far as they can without hitting any dependencies. And then other people are going to come and fill in where they've blocked out, because we're specializing more and we've got more people involved to build a given piece of content. And all these layers of abstraction are helping us let those people work without, you know, kind of waiting on each other. You know, I need you to check in the level so I can add the special effect to this surface, right? So our animation system is one where we spent a great deal of time thinking through these issues. So for us, we had the goal of, we wanted to deliver, just like in Half-Life, we had what we called scripted sequences, which were just custom animations that occurred in the game, and had some simple rules that you could the player could interrupt them. But in Half-Life 2, we wanted a whole set of actual scenes with story going on, and we wanted them to be interactive with the player and parametric to the actions of the player. We made a bunch of choices in animation to make that possible and also make it possible for all the people who have to work on one of those scenes. You've got level designers, a writer, maybe a couple of animators, maybe an audio designer, all having to touch pieces of it, and programmers as well. And so you want them to not meet with lots of resistance from all those other people when they go to make changes and be able to try things out and see the results of them on their computer locally before they go and bring them to a bunch of other people. So just kind of walk through some of the choices we made there to facilitate that. So one of the first things, again, turning to more symbolic linking, more layers of abstraction, and really, I mean, at this point, I think everybody gets, we're using this technique over and over, but it's interesting where we're using it and how and what it makes possible. So I'm going through lots of examples of that. So we have an abstract notion of animation when you're in code or when you're in level design. So it can be a blended set of animations with named blend parameters. It can be an animation that's shared by a bunch of models or overridden by the specific model that you're using. And since this is all done by name, you get some nice effects like I changed the shared database and then all the characters get this new improved walk animation, except this one guy who has a limp and he's got his own special one. But in the AI code, I just say walk and it all works. And if an animator decides tomorrow that he wants the walk sequence to have another layer on it with a gesture in it or a piece of IK, then he can do that, and I don't have to change any of my code. Another kind of important thing is we serialize everything using symbols. So if you have a direct reference to anything in your code and you save it and then you change the model and you load that save game, that reference is kind of not good anymore, right? If it's been boiled down to an index so you can network it or so you could store it cheaply. So in all the cases where we're referencing animations, we'll serialize the symbol. So if actually somebody goes and changes the order or the selection of the animation or where it sits or what character it's in, then it's just going to pass through the symbol lookup. We also do symbolic links to bones. So you can build a good case of that is all the weapons in the game. So characters are holding weapons, and the weapons have links back to the character's skeleton. And those are just done by name, so if you change the skeleton of the weapon or change the skeleton of the character, you don't have to recompile the other one. And you can make choices about that. If I decide that I want to animate the bolt action on all the guns, then I can do that and not have to worry about any of the characters who carry them, because I know it's all going to be linked up at runtime. It also means we can share animation among models that have different skeletons, so you can add a new bone to the specific character because he's got this piece of equipment that other characters don't have, and you can have animation for it in your specific animations, or it can be rigidly attached to a bone that animates in all the shared animations. And we'll do skeleton merges for models, like that's what I was talking about for the weapon, by name. And again, it's all dynamically linked, all at runtime. In order to realize these scenes, one thing we had to go to, which I guess was probably discussed pretty heavily at the first part of this conference, is a more composite, synthesis-oriented model for animation. And so in Half-Life 2, animation is a set of independent layers. You can have an in-way blend for a particular animation, like walking, where you have specific sidestepping and walking backwards and walking forwards. You can have partial skeleton animations. So if you want to have a character who's walking sideways and talking to you and gesturing like this, then we layer those two things together, and the gesture only affects the part of the skeleton that you've animated. We have facial animation going on and procedural eye movement, so people are looking at things and blinking independent of all this other stuff, and we do that procedurally. Lip sync is separate from facial animation for us, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. Both of them move vertices on the face, but they're independent layers, which is really handy. And IK is another procedural layer where you can solve IK constraints and feed that in. So by choosing to do this really composited semi-procedural system for animation, we can change all these things independently. Some examples of that, one thing I have here is we authored characteristic gestures and postures for characters, and then we build a bunch of higher level animations out of those by recombining them different ways. You could change the timing, or you could change the blend parameters, and you could just get a really rich set of animation just by recompositing. I'm sure lots of other people are using that leverage as well. But the big thing about going to this, where a lot of it's being procedural and a lot of it's reused, by having all these layers, you can reuse the bits of the layers when you put them back together, I guess is what I'm saying. We were able to ship 3 hours of scenes in Half-Life 2 versus about 10 minutes of scripted sequences in Half-Life 1. We had more time. I mean, the project took a fair amount longer, but we didn't have significantly more animation resources. So even if we took twice as long in animation production, it's still a big win by going to this system. So where kind of animation all came together was in these scenes. And just to get more concrete about that, we would author scenes as sort of like we authored levels, where you're putting a bunch of things together, right? You're referencing some characters. You're saying, and always by name, these characters are going to walk to these marks in space. They're going to look at these objects. They're going to face these other characters. One could be the player. Then the level designer could move those marks around, move the objects around, and the animation, since it's all parametric and composited, can still play on that scene. So you've got, again, we're creating a separate space where the person doing the animation can change the gestures, the person doing the level can change the position of the objects in the room. It's hard for the player to see this scene, so I'm going to move the character over here, and I don't have to reauthor the whole sequence to do that, because I've developed it as a composite model instead of as a rigid sequence. And then some of the stuff is being driven by AI, which means as the game changes or the navigation system changes or as the player intentionally tries to put objects in the way of the characters in the scene, we have AI code that's running under this, synthesizing some of the movement. So you can say, I want you to move over here, and it uses navigation. I want you to face... I want you to face this direction and look at that picture, and all of that stuff gets done procedurally with some AI, which is a lot of what makes it interactive with the player. So we have, in lots of the scenes, the characters say specific lines to you and they gesture to you, and you can see if you play Half-Life 2, as you move around the room, they still play the scene to you, even if you're standing somewhere else, which is really cool. It makes you feel like you actually have some impact on it. We actually call this tool the face poser, because you also do facial animation there. But where you're laying out a scene there, you put symbols for the animations, the gestures, and the speech, you can change. One cool thing is you can change the gesture timing per instance that you put it down. So you can use the same gesture animation for saying, well, that's the way it is, and well, that's the way it is. Just rechange that same, just put a different timing on that and reuse it. The idea is, again, the animation system is going to build the output composite from all of this, all of the above stuff. One place where this all works to great advantage is localization. So Half-Life 2. I think we shipped 11 languages simultaneously, and 9 of them had full audio localization, and we also had full lip sync localization in all of those 9 languages. So because we had this composite, it meant that we could just go in, redo the lip sync track for all those waves, and merge it back in without animators having to go back and touch it. And in a couple of cases, they did. We have the opening scene where the G-Man's like right in your face, and his mouth is a quarter of the screen. And so even after we did some automatic processing on the lip sync to generate that for localization, but we did go back and have animators, you know, to go and do the Chinese one to make sure it looked good, because at that one, it's right up in your face. But are you have some questions?
Yeah. Can you talk just for a second when the animator's making one of these scene animations with the links to the AI coming up, are they like animating with Domi that is the player, and then you back figure out that that's the player and this is the look at, or they annotate that, they mark that up specifically? And how do they mark up the animations to link to the AI?
Right, okay. So right now, so this is one thing that we want to improve, is that the preview, while they're working on this, isn't the end resulting game. They still have to go load the game and play the scene and the level to get the full preview. In the editor, they just play the scene facing the camera, and so those AI commands aren't running while they lay out the scene. You have to load the game and then run them. And so if you say face to player, then you load up the game and you're the player. And so you move around and they face to you. So you have we have kind of a two-cycle test on that, where you have to test it in the game as well as in the editor.
Right, but if you just add the author time, is there, how do you say it's a face to the player when they're doing animation?
Oh, okay.
So, or something, and then how do they mark that up?
All right, so they do that in the face poser. You have a timing track, an animation track with all the, here's the audio that's going on, you can see the WAV files, and then you have curves for emphasis on gestures, you have curves for getting into animations, and the AI command. So it looks like it's another animation timeline independent of what you did in Maya. So what you did in Maya or XSI or Max is make a sequence that then could get composited into a blend or a set, and then in the face poser you reference that and you build a sort of a meta timeline that includes the other information. I think we just shipped our SDK, and I think for some reason the face poser didn't ship with it, but it's supposed to be in there. So it's maybe it's already updated. But you can download the Half-Life 2 SDK and go load the face poser and load the scenes and see how they fit together if you are really really curious and want to dig into it. It's not in the place where the lookout occurs is in the face poser, in the scene tool.
No, I understand. If the animator changes the animation, so it's longer, for instance.
Right.
How does that link back in? Do we need to redo all the face poser stuff?
Well, the face poser has a timeline where you can just slide stuff around like that. So if you made the dialogue last longer and you needed then to move it over, then you'd have to move that over in face poser. I think we have some automatic locking for some things, but I don't know off the top of my head whether if you make a line of dialogue longer, if it automatically slides everything over. There are some timing tags you can put down. I just don't know the exact functionality that we shipped with that. But all the information's there for us to do that. So we know how long the piece of dialogue is, and we know that you want to align this gesture with a particular point in it. But if you re-record the WAV file, you're probably going to have to move it if the emphasis moves. Or in your case, if the right time to look at the player given this line of dialogue moves, or given the animation. But I guess the important thing is it's not a canned sequence where the guy looks at the player, right? The looking at the player is composited from some procedural animation. So you could change the sequence and the guy would still look at the player at the right time, even though you didn't animate the looking at the player head movement. That's going to get added in procedurally. I want to get through a couple of these other things. So audio, if we want to drill down into more of that, we can do it when we hit the Q&A. Audio, we made similar choices about abstracting in a way so you don't embed any audio directly in levels or models or other script files. We have these specific text config files where our audio designers specify all the sound effects. So every wave that plays in the game actually has a record in the text file or in a text file that you can adjust the volume and pitch shift and attenuation and which set it's in for voice dealing and stuff like that. And then we have another kind of script for soundscapes, which is, again, the same kind of idea. In Half-Life, level designers would create sort of the soundscape with a sound designer, and they would say, well, there's a projector over there, and it's making like a fan noise, so I'm going to put a little fan noise sound source there. And then in the back of the room, you can kind of hear the noise of people talking outside, so I put a little people talking outside sound that comes from the back of the room, right? And then, you know, that's really simple kind of building the sound. So in Half-Life 2, we kind of put a layer of abstraction in there. So they put a thing called a soundscape, which has some reference positions, but it just has a name to go run to build the sound. So you just say, I'm doing the meeting room sound, and there are a couple of positions in here that are relevant, and here they are. And then the sound designer can go hook whatever sounds he wants to those. He can add a bunch of looping ambient, you know, noise. He can control the mix, the DSP of the environment. All of that stuff comes from the script, and it's just, you know, same idea. Sound designer works in isolation. So with all of these things, our sound designer was able to like redo the mix for the whole game. Like in this particular scene where these people are talking and people are shooting, I can't hear what they're saying. And so he can go to that positional soundscape and say, well, use this mixer. And then he's got the mixer setting where that's classifying all the sounds into what they are and says, well, turn down weapons and turn up voiceover in this room. You know. And so it just meant that he could go over the whole game and kind of iterate on the sound as a whole. And we got a lot better sound because, you know, it didn't live in all of these files where he had to go talk to someone or wait for them to release the lock on it in version control so he could edit it. You know, just getting rid of the dependency there and letting him work directly on the sound and iterate on it in isolation. So, again, it's just more examples of how we did that. One thing I had on the last slide and also on this slide where we have kind of tying the sound and the physics together, we have a system for automatic DSP. So as the player's walking around, there's ray tracing going on that's, you know, shoots rays out of the player's ears and says, what's the near field surfaces, what is the sound reflecting off of? And the audio designer can say, well, you know, it's this wall is really dead. If we had a concrete floor, it's really live, you know. And he can add those material properties in using a physics script, and then he can read them in his sound code and then configure the reverb based on all the surfaces that are near the player's ears. So, you know, by moving this stuff out, not being hard-coded, having a layer of abstraction in it, we can do some... it's be a lot of work to get all this right if, you know, an audio designer and a programmer and maybe a couple programmers had to work together all the time to say, okay, but, you know, how do we add this to the database, or how can I make sure that I can change the sound just for that, or I can change the DSP parameters for, you know, you might have the physics programmer and the audio programmer and the sound designer involved in making some of these changes. So kind of just making it generic and adding layers of abstraction to content means we can do this kind of stuff. You know, the audio designer can do it himself. And we use the same kind of thing for, you know, the physics properties have references to the sound scripts, like I was saying before. So all the impact sounds are just references to a name. So when things hit each other, you have the set of sounds you might want to play for specific objects and materials. And then a sound designer could say, hey, I don't like that sound. I'm going to go edit it and just edit it. You could do that with a wave file, but you can't like change it to a set of random waves because it's too repetitive unless you have the layer of abstraction there. Or easily reduce the volume and add some pitch shift or something like that without having to change a bunch of waves. So, like, you just go in a text file and he can reduce the volume on, you know, 30 different sound effects or modify it without, you know, going into a sound editor and changing the wave files. Or maybe he wants all of his wave files to live at full scale so he doesn't have to have a separate source and mixed version of it or something like that. And we push some of those things into the abstraction layer. Just when you have these kinds of abstractions, it becomes a really convenient place to do things like that. So that's kind of the litany of examples for how we work that into our content process, how we work abstraction and linking into there. And I wanted to talk about a couple of other kind of high-level tech decisions we made. One of them was to work on distributed computing. We had a lot of heavy offline pre-processing steps in Half-Life 2. The biggest ones were, we want to do full rebuilds of all the code, and that's not that heavy, but, it could take 20 or 30 minutes to do a rebuild of everything on a single machine. We wanted to do lighting on levels, pre-computed radiosity, and that could take hours in Half-Life. We would build these big, SMP boxes, four processor systems, and spend a lot of money on them. And then, after a period of time, they would be totally worthless. And you spend a lot of effort recoding your tools to be threaded because, it's significantly more difficult to write threaded code than non-threaded code. And we just found that incrementally going to distributed computing isn't that hard. Like, once you're threaded, you really only have to do communication. And you can do that systematically. There's a public standard called MPI, and we did our own wrinkle of it that cheats in a couple places and uses Windows file sharing and stuff like that. But, it's only an incremental step if you're already doing threading to go to distributed processing. And so it turns out that this scales a lot higher than threading because you can certainly put a lot more machines than processors on a task. You have to have kind of high latency because for low latency stuff, you're not in the same computer anymore. The network isn't going to be that fast. It's cheaper to buy four machines than it is to maintain four fast machines than to get a four processor system. And it's way cheaper to just go ahead and buy 10 than to buy, two or three, four processor systems that follow some technology curve, right? And you're totally going to beat it because of the scalability. Like I said before, we used IncrediBuild. We did have to upgrade to a gigabit network in the company. We use all the company's machines as slaves. So everybody's got this task running that when their screensaver kicks in, it turns their CPU over to the pool. And the network traffic, mostly of getting IncrediBuild up over eight machines, was pretty high. So if you're at, if you're old school and a 10 megabit, then you're going to have to upgrade your network if you want to do this. But in general, with our VMPI, we were able to write caching and custom caching and networking code that got the bandwidth down pretty low. And if our router actually did multicast, I think we'd have it down even lower. So for radiosity, we got down to most of our maps, even though they're larger maps, compile in minutes on a 32 machine cluster versus hours when we were building Half-Life. Visibility, pre-computed, the same kind of thing. We do that in minutes on the system. The shader recompile, only took, I guess, 15 minutes or something, but that's a long time to wait. And if you turn that down to, 30 or 40 seconds, then that's a pretty huge win for programmers. So in general, I would say you've got a lot of high latency stuff going on. Think about distributed computing if you're not already. It was really successful for us. It wasn't as hard as doing threading. So, like on scale, if you're already doing threading, distributed computing is just a little bit more work. It's not like a lot of new things to learn. Now, something else I just wanted to touch on. Optimization kind of changed. When we shipped Half-Life on the PC, anyway, we were often trying to find out how to not run so many instructions, writing a tighter loop, and your optimization problems were focused around systems. So like we had our software renderer, which consumed most of our CPU cycles, or even the hardware renderer or animation, where you're pumping triangles or iterating vertices or anything that you do lots and lots of times, right? And so really, it was pretty clear that, hey, you've got way too much geometry, or you're trying to run the software renderer at 1280 and it's not going to be fast enough. Or if it was in leaf code, an AI programmer decided that for this particular decision, he needed to cast 1,000 rays at the environment to figure it out. So it was kind of more obvious when you're screwing up and how to optimize it. But this time around, we ran into a lot of problems where we were memory bound, and these are a lot easier to get trapped in. And I don't know, I'd be interested in some of the discussion to find out if this is true for everybody else. But especially with C++ code and layered APIs, you get into, just calling a few functions on, say, 100 objects is going to touch a lot of different cache lines. And it's not too hard to do that a few times and totally wipe out your cache and have some loop. I've measured cases where simple loops in our code ran 80 times faster when in cache than not, doing the same instructions. So it's a big deal. And it requires some rethinking about how you architect your code, and especially the systems that the Leaf stuff's going to get built on. And you end up making copies of data, or we did, making copies of data, co-locating things for how they're going to be processed, thinking again about, memory alignment and structure packing and all these things you used to do to fit in RAM that you think, oh, the RAM is really huge now in a PC. Most of it's textures anyway. The code's not that big. Well, turns out, performance is the specter that makes you think about that stuff again. So we're CPU bound pretty often because of memory. And then otherwise we're like fill bound on the graphics card or IO bound loading stuff from the hard drive. But it's just one thing I wanted to mention and kind of want to hear what other people's experiences are with that. Yeah. So when you queued them up, were you copying data so that you'd have everything that you needed in the loop, or how do you keep the?
Previously, they might have called a routine to go generate an effect. It instead, just got it put on an effect queue.
But it makes a small packet that describes the effect and sticks it in the queue.
And later on, there's a thing that says, "Okay, here's all the effects I accumulated in this frame." And
right.
Then a very tight loop and processes them.
Yeah.
And that pattern went over and over and over again, all over, where I had all these little weird little data managers that were not necessarily intuitive, but in the end of the day, they were cache coherent.
Yeah. Yeah, so we've had some similar things happen, but I think it's kind of an interesting problem, and there's a bunch of future work there.
One thing that was also surprising on recent work was instruction cache, that we used to never seem to be that much of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But just like counting instruction caches, this especially with like more object-oriented architectures.
Yeah, where you just the number of things you touch just to do something is they're spread out more, right? I mean, that's kind of the general thing I was talking about with C++ and layered object code. Yeah.
I was wondering specifically about what you said early on and using interfaces with the pure virtual functions to define the interface.
Right.
Especially on low-level interfaces, that introduces the virtual function call overhead, which hits the instruction cache, and especially on consoles where cache is smaller than PCs.
So one simple thing to do, if that actually wasn't an issue for us, but if it is an issue, the first thing to do is to make a flat copy of the dispatch table in whoever owns the interface, right? So you get rid of one of the interactions there, just by saying instead of object arrow v table arrow function, you just copy the whole v table into a structure and just do you know, one jump. But yeah, if you're going to have to move something, if you're in a thousands of times calling through the interface, then you're going to have to move it to the other side. We didn't have a lot of problems with that because I think our interfaces are higher level. And in the cases where they were low level, like rendering, like we have a drawing, obviously, interface to draw a batch of triangles. But D3D's overhead for doing that dwarfs the VTable costs. So, you know, it's not a... it's not, you know, you wish that was the problem because then we could go attack that one, but it's like D3D calls. So
yeah, we're going to hold off on official full open season question until day's end.
Okay.
Go
yeah.
To the microphone and make sure it gets recorded.
So. Okay. Yeah, I actually am pretty much done. I just wanted to summarize my so things that work well for us, isolating creative tasks, whether they're programming or content. Thinking about your architecture based on the workflow and the people doing it, both in the content and the code, was successful for us. You know, for scripting, we ended up doing most of the stuff that was like programming in C++, and most of the stuff that was scripting was either the Entity.io thing or really simple text. I would call them configuration files. And just the idea is you get faster, higher quality iteration when you're focused on an isolated task. Using dynamic linking so you can achieve that isolation and reduce dependency and reducing your compilation steps or making them less expensive wherever you can. And the upside of this is you can have a larger team operating more in parallel and you have individual people contributing, doing more of what they want to do, which is just add value to the game, you know, all day, every day. And that's really all I have.
So we're going to do some questions and pass around the mic. I want to take a question, though, right now, going way back to early in your talk.
Okay.
An example of this parallelism that you just talked about was in coding, you know, everybody's working in these modules in as much as possible that auto-register.
Yes.
And run at particular times.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, you know, order dependencies need to be a little more fine-grained than,
yes.
You know, just call me every frame. Like, an example of that is, hey, I'm firing the machine gun, and there's, like, a muzzle flash. And if that happens before the gun rotates and animates, then the flash is, like, a frame behind. It's, everybody's seen that, right? So, like,
right.
What... I'm sure you have a mechanism for dealing with that, and, like,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so what actually happened for us on that very problem is... In general, most of the things you're doing don't have an order dependency. Then a lot of the ones that do have a simple hierarchical dependency. This thing must occur after this thing. And so that's really easy to describe by just making one thing call the other. You know, the hook through this thing is just through the other thing.
Right. So do you find that
so like drawing muzzle flashes happens in the weapon rendering code. You know, it's an effect that gets attached to it.
So does that happen often enough that it impedes your effort to parallelize? Because
most of the cases where we had that were people doing a system where they're trying to use the Leaf tool because it's all convenient, and actually they're trying to plug in a more core system that has, you know, I have to run before any of the game logic thinks about the frame because I'm going to set up some system that they're going to call into, right? And so that's really like the 1% case for us. But in the specific case of like rendering effect order and attachment, we generally, the way we solve that is in our client rendering code, the stuff is done, we have sort of on-demand caches. So if you try to render the muzzle flash, you ask the gun for the position, it knows it hasn't gotten updated that frame. It does the whole update and then caches it, and then you render the muzzle flash, and then later you render the gun.
So it's basically, by doing it as late as possible, it just kind of magically happens in the right order.
It's not, I mean, yeah, you want to do it as late as possible.
Yeah.
But that's not totally clean, but the benefits of... It doesn't really. I guess the problem doesn't go away when you don't have the auto registration stuff, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a counterpoint to that, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing I'll mention is these slides will be available on the website. They're not in the printed material right now. Casey.
Yes.
this actually reach?
So I had a question on the thing you were talking about, how like the idea on the code side at the outset, at least, was to kind of like have people define an interface, like a DLL layer, and they would kind of own that, and they would, you know, iterate on that, and that kind of would get checked in binarily and that sort of stuff.
Right.
And one of the things that usually happens when you do something like that is that because they don't know what, you know, the usage necessarily is, and maybe they're not specifically thinking about that, you end up with at least the first iteration or two of those DLLs don't really do what the people who are about to use them actually want. So you kind of end up burning some like time there where they like define interfaces that weren't that mappable, and then they like kind of rework them to integrate it with the other DLL and so on.
Okay.
How did you deal with like that part of the process?
So I'm simplifying quite a bit. I'm not, you know, in the slide. Because what I'm really talking about is just after that. So when you're actually designing the interface and building the first working thing, you know, that's going to be a little more interactive with other people. Really, the benefits to this come after when you want to go and re-implement something under the hood, or you want to incrementally add features, or you want to grow that component over time, which is the bulk of the project, right? The first implementation of it does, you need a test case, and we drive everything that we built technology-wise was, there's a piece of game content we're building. So the first thing you do is some kind of rough prototype, get your features, and then, you know, you go right into, okay, we're going to build a piece of game content that requires this technology, and drive the first set of decisions toward getting a good version of whatever that is. Because kind of our philosophy about that is, if you can't do one thing well, then, you know, it doesn't matter what else you do at all, right? So you want to do the first thing, pick something concrete, go do that really well, use that to kind of draw your boundaries. And you know, yeah, you still have to be smart about not paying yourself into a corner. But, you know, you assume that if the developer's smart enough to write the technology system, you know, we didn't really have problems with that, I would say. You know, people made smart choices, and they got all the way finished because they were working on a concrete piece of game content and not sort of generally there. We did have cases of that, but we learned from them quickly, I would say.
All right.
You also mentioned that you were also using some of these components or these DLLs in so that you could also share them across tools as well.
Right.
Did you run into any issues where, especially if you're dealing with something that's primarily a runtime or a game sort of DLL, that it would end up breaking tools because that wasn't the primary focus?
Yes. And actually, that reminds me of something else. So, yes, we did a couple times. I wouldn't say it was a huge problem for us, but the renderer is the same thing that's running in the level editor and in the face poser, right, the low-level rendering layer. And the model and character rendering code is another component that's used in all of those things as well. So you get, you know, a preview of an animated model in the level editor. You want to run the same code the game runs, right? So there were times when people would break that stuff, but in almost every case, it was something really simple. It was more like human error, not testing enough, or not building all the dependents, or not going back and refactoring a piece of code that was similar to the code you refactored in the game, right? So it was usually more of a speed bump than a brick wall. But the other thing that did come up was some of our tools are threaded, and our game is not. And so you might, like, one of the things that I was working on is we load the physics DLL to go do some intersection tests in some of the tools, and those tools are running in threads, and now the physics DLL needs thread context, right? So that, you know, you plug it in and it appears to work, and then you find out, oh yeah, I didn't think about threading in this, and I've got this global variable that's now being shared and not accessed through a critical section or something. So there were a couple of thorny surprises, but for the most part, you know, it was just like, oh yeah, that was just a simple mistake, I'll go correct it, kind of things with that.
Right, yeah. We were sort of thinking about almost separating tools from runtime in that sense, where you have, you know, a shared tool layer, but it might be an integration or something, or you know, often a shared code base, but just to keep it separate. So
I think we're maybe going the other way, because I think probably the next rev of our stuff will be a lot more, the content production will be a lot more tightly integrated with the output. So I hope we can do the scene editing totally in context, where you can go and change the level and the characters and the marks and the commands all in one environment. Because I think that would make us a lot more productive. I mean, again, with the same theory of reducing the time for each iteration, if you know the people who design scenes could sit there and try out their 12 different ideas right there in context with everything working, we'd have much better scenes. And so kind of driving in that direction.
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. That's sort of what we're doing now a little bit, and we've run into the issue of too much, you know, it being very, the runtime code getting very overly burdened and complicated compared to what the tools code is, just because you end up having stuff that really isn't necessary for the game but is more necessary, or you need different ways of accessing data,
right?
Or a more open way to access data in a tool than you do at runtime, and we sort of pay a complexity cost.
To the extent that we've done it so far, we have exactly that, where there are two databases, and so there's the compiled, I guess we call them fat and skinny, right? There's the runtime skinny asset that's been baked down into being optimal, and then there's the edit time fat version of it. And then while you're running the edit part of it, you're really consuming and reading and writing from the really fat representation. And you load a component that does all it does a really inefficient version of the runtime work straight on the fat data. So I guess it's almost like having two tracks, right, in the small, but in the large scheme, you're in the same program, and whatever you're not editing is running fully baked down, right? So if you're not touching the walls and the lights, those are being really optimal while you mess with the character. So, it's the theory anyway. Well, we haven't finished it. This is just kind of what we're, and hey, it may not work out, right? I'm not doing a speech about how that's the greatest thing. It's just what we're trying. So after we're done with it, I'll have a long list of problems we ran into and why it's a bad idea, but right now it has a lot of, you know, we're really chasing the shorter iteration cycle, and it seems like a promising thing. But that is the idea, to do incremental compilation. But like I said, I don't have an existence proof of it.
Yeah, there are kind of two questions, but I'm going to ask them both, and you can aggregate, because I think
you have only two questions, Chris.
I have two questions right now, Jay.
Okay.
I reserve the right in the future to ask questions.
Okay.
The example of where scripting failed is really useful information. And so the first part of the question is, what are some other examples like scripting that didn't work out the way you thought, like intuitive things? And then the second question is kind of the obvious question given the topic of this thing, which is, what the hell took so long? I mean, all this is great information, but like
yeah.
The game took forever to ship. So yeah. You kind of address that.
I thought about in my opening thing, saying, assuming you want to take advice from a guy who just took 6 years to ship a game. But let me answer your first question first. So Entity.io was something that tended more towards scripting initially, where what we thought we were designing was a language. And so we built a bunch of micro entities, you know, a bunch of reusable concepts, like here's the thing that adds numbers together, here's the thing that stores state, here's the things that compares, here's the thing, you know, and it's basically writing, you know, a scripting language, right? And what happened with our designers was that they didn't want to be programmers at that scale. They wanted those things to be put into a box that did something that they understood, right? And so it was another case where then someone wrote the entity that kept score of a game and gave them that, and then they threw away all the addition and state story. I mean, that's not an actual example, but so that was another one where we thought we needed scripting, but in fact, it wasn't the path to the most efficient solution, I guess.
Are there non-scripting examples of things that didn't work? Like, what if we tried to render anything and it blew up, or if we didn't?
There's plenty. I don't know how much. We tried a bunch of different rendering things that didn't work. We tried a bunch of physics things that didn't work. You know, I guess I could talk for a long time about that if people are interested.
We'll see if it gets hit on in any specific questions coming up.
Okay. So but I questions? Still have to talk about what took so long.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not trying to get off the hook. So I would say, you know, a lot of what took so long were things that had nothing to do with the game. With Half-Life 2, I should say, you know, we finished Half-Life and it was really successful, and we wanted to follow it with something that wouldn't disappoint people who, you know, had you know, crazily high expectations of the first one. And so we went off in sort of infinite ambition mode for a little while. And one of the things that's apparent in my talk is that the company grew a lot in between Half-Life and Half-Life 2. I mean, the dev team tripled. In fact, when we shipped, you know, we had about 20 programmers, I guess, in Half-Life 2 when we shipped. So, you know, compared to 5 when we shipped Half-Life. So, you know, that's a pretty big jump. And then we also shipped Steam, which someone could do a whole talk on the whole, you know, architecture and creation of that, which is another dev team that I'm not counting in those 20 people. So we grew a lot, and that took a lot of time and took focus away from making games for a little while. And so that was one of the main contributors. And then I would say infinite ambition mode is not very healthy. And you've got to build something. And if your only standard is it's got to be the best thing ever, it's really hard to build anything and then look at it and keep it. Right, so we spent a lot of time kind of holding ourselves to an impossible standard and basically failing to deliver anything finished. So we have a lot of, we have a boneyard behind us of stuff that is really cool but isn't like a finished game, you know. And I think the other side of it is that we had good people and we were amassing lots of cool stuff. It wasn't like the game was, a train wreck. And it was like, it was getting cooler. And there was new stuff you could do. And there were new features. And someone had just made this thing that was just so cool. But when you try to make, okay, this is the game, it's like, well, that's not good enough yet, right? And so it's not like we hemorrhaged people or anything. Everyone was still thinking the project was great. And you know, it was going to be really cool. But the reality was they had no idea when it was going to ship, right? And that was what eventually happened is after, you know, the second year of, yeah, it's probably, you know, another year out, then people started to say, okay, you know, we're gonna make what we can make and go make the game. And you know, we shipped that game instead of we probably have at least a game's worth of stuff that came before it. So... cut. Yeah, I don't know. That's a really hard question. I mean, I'm really happy with how the game turned out, and I think we did a good job editing. And so when I think of stuff we cut, you know, it was kind of at the end when it was like, okay, this one part of the level isn't as polished as the rest. And like, you know, example of that we had in the coast. There's another whole section where we were just kind of teaching you how to drive the car, and you know, stuff you can run into and drive around little obstacles. There's like a ramp you can jump over and just, you know, sort of like go have fun in a nonlinear space. And we just didn't get that to be cool enough, and players weren't having enough fun with it. So we just like took the road that led to that and threw it away and connected it to the road after it. But I mean, I think that was like a good edit. So I'm not giving you an example of something that was particularly painful. More of the painful stuff was stuff that didn't work out earlier. You know, before we were in the final production where you're actually cutting stuff, it's like you have to make choices about how a bunch of people are going to spend their time making things good. And you've got a bunch of promising stuff, and you've got, you know, you look and say, well, this is more promising or more close to being reality than this, or this has some really cool art but doesn't have the fundamental fun thing yet, you know, or this has the fundamental fun thing but no art. And you're probably going to pick the fundamental fun thing with no art because it's a whole lot easier to bet on succeeding at the art than to bet on succeeding at the the fun thing for the cool concept, right? So kind of the painful stuff was at that stage where you're having to say, okay, we're going to stop working on this. We've spent enough time on it. We don't have the, you know, the one big success. We need to go with the things we have. From my perspective, it's interesting to hear what people outside our company have to say about it. I mean, Half-Life 2 is a really dense game in terms of the number of things we packed into it. So even though I see all the stuff we left out, I mean, I still look at it and say, oh my God, I can't believe we shipped all of these different things, especially when I compare it to all the other games I've worked on. I just, you know, where we had much more a couple of things we're doing, you know, well, and we have tons of things that we packed in there. Like I said, at least that's how I feel about it. So it doesn't feel like wow, we cut the soul of the game or something or anything like that. It's like we managed to ship all of this. It's, you know, pretty staggering. So,
all right, so we're going to open it up a little more now. We're going to take either questions for Jay further, or if you have, you know, an anecdote or a statement about your own development experience that bears on something that Jay's talked about as well. So Charles has had his hand up for a while, so we're going to go to him first.
I kind of have a question about the way you're breaking things down for leaf coding. I'm curious kind of like how many DLLs you have and how, you know, if I'm writing things like a module of AI or something like that, is that totally isolated or are there big chunks of code that go together? And then kind of related to that, with the whole Entity I/O system and the hookups,
yep.
It seems like when designers want new behavior, you have to have programmers involved writing new code hooks for them for the Entity I/O because they don't have a scripting language where they can really make new behaviors. So do you wind up having kind of leaf coder programmers working closely with designers and constantly writing little features for one-off things?
Okay, so it's a couple of questions. I'll start with the last one because I have a really specific answer for that. So, Entity I/O did sort of extend over time, and designers hit. We built a lot of entities in there that were sort of generically useful. Like we have in the AI code, we have these things called AI assaults, which are it's kind of like a scripted battle command. That you can trigger and parameterize. Like, these guys are all going to move to this location, wait for some event, and then they're going to move to these other locations and attack. You know, like a simple concept like that. And so when the player does this, you have them all form up and play some animations, and then when the player gets close enough, they all rush out to their other positions. So you can use that to script, you know, hundreds of different things. It's a kind of a, you know, there's a right size, I guess, for one of these behaviors. But anyway, we did create new behaviors, and one of the things we did with the team, kind of independent of what I'm talking about engineering the pipeline, was more engineering the team. And Half-Life 2 was made by a set of production teams, so we have four groups at the end with a fair amount of autonomy who are responsible for the final completion of particular areas of the game. And I don't mean like a minute of it. I mean an environment, you know. Like the Ravenholm, you know, Zombie Town is in one of these groups built that. It's not to say they did all the work that went into it. It's just that they were responsible for it and they drove it to completion for a period of time, right? And so that group would have a critical mass of people necessary to kind of get all the decisions made. And in all of those groups, we had programmers and level designers. So most of those things, you know, they'd have their own private branch in many cases of the code where they're just like throwing features back and forth and, okay, here, try it this way, here, try it this way. And so those guys worked in pretty close collaboration. We actually put those groups as much as possible in shared workspaces as well. So, you know, we had a couple of big rooms that once we got into that production phase, we just moved that whole group in there and then, you know, they pull other people from the team in to do specific things. Like, you know, they have an animator in there or a couple of artists in there for a while they're working on animation or art parts of the game, or they're concepting out a new space. They'd have some guys who are on the art team involved in that part of it because They need to have it all make sense and fit with the art direction and all of that stuff. But ultimately, each one of those groups was responsible for delivering it. So that group being all together in a room, closely collaborating, helped us solve the iteration problem you're talking about, where there's the back and forth with coders. And that worked really well for us, and we're going to keep doing that. So trying to rewind to your other question about how many DLLs we have and structure and what it's like. We pulled stuff into components as, you know, kind of as it made sense. But in the case of AI, I mean, our server-side game logic is all in one component, and that makes a bunch of things easier. And since most of those people work incrementally, you know, with edit and continue, it wasn't a big issue for them. It's kind of like the biggest section, the biggest DLL, I guess, we have. But the thing like the sound system that resolves all the names and all that's in another DLL. And you're just saying play the sound event and you pass a string into it, you know, and that at that level. Probably like as we're doing stuff going to consoles, I think we probably find a hybrid approach to that where we don't have all the strings sitting in memory. Like I'm sure you guys working on the Xbox don't do that. I would guess. So we build some more tokenizing technology and still try to keep as much of the late binding as we possibly could. But it's really easy for leaf coders to interact with the sound stuff. You just say, you know, I want to play the sound, or I want to create a moving, you know, living sound. Like there's a one-off, and then there's another thing for sounds that I'm going to envelope and you know, turn on and off, and you know, that kind of thing. So they have a simple abstraction for that sits on top of this other DLL. There's probably on the order of 15 or so DLLs around for the runtime. Yeah.
You then have to merge back once a week or something like that?
So it depends. Depending on the team, I mean, a lot of people on our code base merge from the main tree down to their branch at least every day, like sometimes more often. And then a lot of people would check in their work every day or two. We kind of believed in everything staying running, staying pretty checked in. We just had acceptance tests that people had to run before they would put it back in the main branch. And there were a little, you know, obviously a little bit of people would check in stuff that broke sometimes, but the payoff of the communication you get from your team, of everybody knowing what everybody else is doing and new features coming in, you know, who's doing them and what they're working on, I think that's a pretty big payoff. When your artists all know what all your various programmers are doing on a, you know, every 3 or 4 days or 2 or 3 days, it's pretty cool. You know, they know who to talk to about features. They know when to use them, when to try them. So I think that was a good process.
You say that they knew, were the artists looking at check-in
logs? So check-in, there's an automatic one. We use Perforce that does an automatic check-in log, and then people would write usually edited one that went to the whole team every time they check in. And we did that across the board. By the time we shipped, every time people were revising assets, they would send mail, usually in batches. Like they wouldn't send one for each file or something, but you know, I just checked in the models in the scene for this, and so then the writer would go, oh, I need to go look at the new version of it, right? And we have a real email based communication around that stuff.
All right, we have a question back here.
you actually kind of addressed my question. I'm trying to figure out how to do late binding without storing the strings on primarily a PS2 game.
Use a PC and be lazy is my...
Actually, we one of the presentations later today is going to talk about that. So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, just make sure you attend it. All right.
I had a couple of questions. One regarding, again, the symbolic nature in using strings, passing them around. We do something very similar. We end up, at some point during the build process, we convert all strings to GUIDs, and that's the way we deal with them. But by using strings, we always found anytime you get near a string and you get it in someone's hands where they have to enter a string, they'll type it in wrong, it won't work. And also, you end up with collisions all over the place. Do you how do you deal with collisions? Do you use some sort of namespacing at all?
We didn't have a big problem with collisions. We did have some typos and errors like you're mentioning, but not a huge problem with that. A lot of the stuff when you're developing would just kick out a big fat error when you reference something that wasn't there, so you'd fix it right away. With collisions, I mean, all of these symbols are unique to their purpose, right? So it doesn't matter if you named a sound the same thing you named an actor. It's not like there's a global symbol thing that's tying them together. The code knows you're searching for actors or you're searching for sounds. At least game objects have that, where you name game objects. And so if you named an actor the same thing you named that, pitcher of water, then, and you said play the scene to the actor, it might play it to the pitcher of water, right? So that kind of collision would happen. But in sort of a more global sense, the thing that's turning sound symbols into wave files cannot collide with the thing that turns look at commands into objects, right? So in general, with that stuff, people use long names and they prefix stuff with scope, that was the way people wanted to do it anyway, just to kind of keep track of everything. So all the specific sounds, as an example, for AIs, all have it's like an AI name dot a sound name. So it's not like people made a sound called attack and said, play attack. It was like play combine gunfire, combine dot gunfire or something like that, right? So,
Jay, can you talk about what is a level for you, and what is a prefab, and what is a template and an entity within your levels? Because you were talking about the different building blocks of your world. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, okay. So for us, when I was saying level in there, it's a little bit of an overloaded term for us, but for most of the slides I'm talking about, our game is still, load a chunk of game, load the next chunk of game, structure. So we don't have a streaming global universe. So we still have the concept of a level. I don't know for how long. It's really attractive to think of the streaming global universe, but it's also really difficult in comparison. It adds a bunch of new problems. But for us, a level is a file on disk that has a finite amount of geometry and then we have another concept which we kind of built around these feature teams that we had, the teams who are implementing areas, where we had chapters, which in the sense of how we communicate to our users, those are more the levels of the game, right? But when I'm talking about levels for the purpose of workflow, it's where it pops up loading screens. So entities are all the game objects are entities. Any AI character is an entity. His weapons an entity. A positional mark in space that's like an interesting thing to AI as an entity, and they have to be entities so that they have the basic entity I/O hooks in them, so that you can send them messages, and they have to be entities so that they have the basic entity serialization, so anything we serialized either was an entity or was hierarchically attached to an entity, I guess is the best way, or embedded in an entity, or otherwise linked to an entity. And the same thing for networking. So when you want to network something, you have to have an entity to do the networking. So it's really like the game object that glues, all of that functionality together. And then people write, when they're doing leaf code, like I was talking about, they write an entity, which is a unit of, unit of game behavior that hooks into entity I/O, hooks into serialization, etc. So when I'm talking about doing that in one file, it's so everything you need to make an entity, you can just derive a class from the entity and go and write, add your hooks, write your functionality. Usually in a level, there are thousands of entities. Not all of them have lifetime scope over the whole level. And so there's the template that you asked about. A template is the textual description of an entity, the hierarchical key value text pair thing that I was talking about. So that's what a template is for one. And so for a lot of the levels, we store just a template until you need to create all the entities. and you push that through a factory and the entities get created. And just to get concrete about it, the entity overhead, I don't remember the exact size of the V table, so I don't know the exact cost of new classes. I think we ended up with roughly like 200K of V tables total in the server game logic, something like that. Entities are about 700 bytes with everything hooked onto them, with support for networking and collision and serialization and all that stuff. No, that's the in-memory runtime thing.
So just to give you an idea. Per type or per instance?
That's the instance.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I was trying to give you both numbers. I don't remember. Like, the per type is mostly about a couple of hooks and the V table. But I don't remember the exact metric for that.
We're going to have to cut off the Q&A for now, but thank you once again, Jay.
All right.
I noticed a lot of you still had questions that we didn't manage to get to. Feel free to ambush Jay during the break or later on today.
Yeah.